Monster Man, special episode, The Monsters of Rogue Trader. Hello, and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm taking a look at the monsters that I find in them, their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. Today's episode is a special episode, brought to you by the generosity and public spirit of my Patreon backers, and in particular, of Patreon backer Kyle. Kyle, by the way, has a YouTube channel, Map Crow. He's an artist and he talks about aspects of his game, but also drawing them and making maps, and you should go and check it out, and not just because he says nice things about my zines. It's very inspirational. Anyway, if you'd like to be like Kyle and get your own special episode, all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. And if you do that, you'll also get access to all new episodes of my other podcast, Patron Deities, which is just about to begin a new season on Haitian voodoo. So Kyle, thank you very much, and I hope that you enjoy today's episode. While we're on the subject of Patreon backers, it's also time to welcome a new patron. This is someone who's gone to patreon.com/monsterman, and they have pledged as little as $1 a month to help support the show. So welcome to new patron, Dave. Dave, thank you very much for your support. Means a lot to me. Okay, let's start with a little bit of background. Rogue Trader is the first edition of the war game Warhammer 40,000. And if all that you've seen of Warhammer 40,000 are the more modern editions, you may find Rogue Trader a little bit different from them. In fact, I think you could argue that Rogue Trader is a little bit different from what even it, first edition, would eventually become. Released in 1987, Warhammer 40,000 Rogue Trader, which was originally just called Rogue Trader and didn't get the Warhammer 40,000 moniker until quite late in its development cycle, as a result, supposedly, of wanting to avoid confusion with another Games Workshop game based on the 2080 character Rogue Trooper. This was a game that had been through a long development process. GW had been noising the release of a sci-fi game called Rogue Trader for years, something of a pet project, and early promotional copy suggests a much more conventional science fiction game, something more like Traveller than what the game later became. By which I don't mean that it was an RPG, but definitely the characters envisioned in the game, especially like later on we'll look at the scenario generator, and the scenario generator definitely seems to be predicated on the idea that the player characters are kind of space mercenaries or space troubleshooters, that they are people who have a ship and go around getting into scrapes, which is much more the description of it like a Traveller game. And the early game, even once it's released, seems to suggest something that is midway between a war game and a role-playing game, with players controlling relatively small groups of characters, sometimes quite strongly individualized, with elements of random generation, etc., etc. Now, that is not what the game winds up being like, and indeed it shakes into something much more like its recognizable modern form pretty early on. But looking at this rulebook as a cultural artifact, it's quite interesting. What that means is that while today the quote-unquote monsters you might associate with Warhammer 40,000 are the Demons of Chaos, or Tyranid Swarms, or maybe the Orcs, in this version of the game, in addition to those kind of playable baddies, although there's no demons and indeed no chaos. Well, there's demons. It's complicated. In this book, there are also monsters that function as like random encounter, wandering monster type of things, much more like what you might expect in a role-playing game. As your characters, you know, explore the table, the game master might reveal the presence of these monsters. And it is sort of assumed or recommended that this game has a game master, which I think is one of the reasons that this mode of play never caught on, since it is hard enough to find an opponent, let alone an opponent and a game master. Now, we're going to go through some of the list of monsters in this game, and you might wonder what it is that unites them, and I don't know if there's one thing, but I do think we can identify some trends. There are three categories of monsters, and the first lot we're not going to cover in any real detail, because these are warp creatures, and we have actually already done them in a special episode, and if I remember, which I won't, I will put a link in the show notes, but if not, you can just find it in the feeds archive. Second, you have alien creatures, and third, you have alien plants. So we're not going to talk about the plants very much. We'll do a quick overview of the warp creatures, and then we'll look at the alien creatures, okay? So warp creatures are beings that inhabit the warp, the dimension that underlies physical reality, and I would say that broadly speaking, these are more what you might think of as like horror genre monsters, right? So we've got the Astral Hound, basically a hound of Tyndalos from the Frank Belknap long story of the same name. We've got the Astral Spectre, a kind of psychic ghost. We've got the Enslavers, mind-controlling psychic tentacle orbs. the Cycnoine, psychic parasitic wasps. We've got vampires, which are vampires. We've got warp entities, which are your basic demons. And we've got zombies, which are zombies. Straightforward enough. Over in the alien creature section, we've got the Amble, a big armored brute with pincers, lives in underground tunnels and, you know, sometimes is disturbed by mining activity or whatever. We've got the Bouncer, a big round monster, the epitome of a random creature. It kind of hops around the battlefield, boinging into people. I think of it as a little bit like the beach ball from Darkstar. We've got the carnivorous sand clam, which is basically a landmine that neither side on the board knows about. We've got the Catacan Devil, a ferocious monster that's a bit like a giant scorpion and a bit like a giant centipede. We've got the Catacan Face Eater, a deadly monster that resembles a face cloth. Like, it's just kind of like a little flat thingy. And if it gets attached to your face, it injects you with its eggs, and then they burrow their way out of you and repeat the cycle. It specifically says that the fact that Catacan Face Eaters like hot, moist environments, like they live in the steamy jungles of the death world of Catacan, that means that when they're in buildings, they often wind up in bathrooms, because they're attracted to, like, shower steam, and therefore their resemblance to a face flannel has led to tragedy. It even says that this monster on the table could be represented by a little blob of plasticine. Next, we have the crawlers, subterranean drill squids that hunt vibrations, so things that are making a lot of noise on the ground could be attacked by crawlers. They are the favorite food of the Catacan Devil. We got crotalids, who are basically kind of teleporting alligators. And we get a little view behind the curtain here, where Priestley, Rick Priestley, the author of Warhammer 40,000, says, quote, "The creature was inspired by the availability and relative cheapness of toy zoo crocodiles," close quotes. We got the Cathalian Cudbear, which is basically a big purple bear. You got dinosaurs, both wild and farmed for meat, in what I take to be a nod to the 2000 AD comic series Flesh. We got the Pharaoh Beast, a creature that digests metal, and which is very clearly based on the Rust Monster from D&D. We've got the Gene Stealer. Not quite what the Gene Stealer would eventually be, but pretty close to it. Not as much in terms of appearance, which is quite different, but in terms of its gist, in that it is the alien from Alien, but with this complex life cycle, and the chance that later generations of Gene Stealer hybrid could be quite intelligent. We've got giant insectoids, which are big bugs. We've got giant spiders, same. We've got the Groks. Groks are big lizards that, like, stampede and trample you as soon as they look at you. They kind of fulfill the role that cows play in Earth dialogue, so it's not uncommon to hear people called, like, as strong as a Grox. He's as dumb as a Grox, right? Like as if to say ox. We got the Gyrinx, a psychic cat that acts as a psyker's sidekick and, like, confers them certain bonuses. This is something that has kind of come back in the modern game. There is a model available of a Gyrinx, although I think it's just sort of, like, accompanies one special character rather than being a thing that's common. We got the horse. A horse. We got the Lashworm, another kind of landmine monster that burrows into the ground and then attacks with its tentacles, a bit like a barnacle or something, but on land and much larger. We got the Mimic, a shape-shifting, pickpocketing monkey that follows people around and tries to turn into them and then make off with their equipment to complete the illusion. But once it gets out of a certain distance of them, it reverts to its monkey self. We've got the Terra Squirrel, a carnivorous flying squirrel. The Razor Wing, a dangerous bird with knife-like feathers. The Rippy Fish, basically a piranha. We've got swarms, large masses of smaller insects or whatever. And we've got the Sunworms, solar-powered lightning maggots. And I'm sure there's probably some that I'm forgetting, but that's still a lot to be going on with. So given this fairly extensive bestiary, the three sections add up to about 20 pages in total, what was the envisioned use of these creatures in games? There is a section on creating death world games, a death world being a world, the biosphere of which is inimical to human life, full of poisonous and predatory animals and so forth. Catacan, much discussed in Warhammer 40k, is sort of the archetypal death world. But I don't know how common those ever were, and that is an idea that seems very much to have died out in later versions of the game. I think it was more the case, and certainly this is how I have experienced this when playing Rogue Trader, that random animal encounters kind of would happen on the board of another scenario. So, you know, orcs would be fighting marines over a ruined temple, but also when you cross the stream, you would have to roll for Rippy Fish, or there would be a nest of Catacan Devils between you and the flight recorder of the crashed spaceship you were trying to retrieve, or whatever it was. Honestly, I think if you've ever played Stargrave or Frostgrave, this is kind of the thing that you could most easily compare it to, a game where there is a main mission, and sometimes these creatures are part of that mission. So, you know, for example, in the Frostgrave scenario, the worm hunts. The worm is like an integral part of what's going on. But other times, they're just random encounters that are attracted by all the noise you're making. You can see this in some of the suggested scenarios. So got some dice here. Got my Rogue Trader rulebook. Turn to page 240. All right. For motives, we've got 51. Raid and destroy an important target. And for the specific scenario, we've got 88. An alien planet is about to be invaded by a mighty flotilla of human ships and troops. However, the world's defenses are formidable. The flotilla would be shot to pieces if an immediate assault were launched. A small force of elite troops must try and destroy as many missile and defense laser sites as possible before the main force goes in. They will land by landing pod and must hold out until the invasion starts. So we have a small group of troops alone on an alien planet. Perfect time for them to run into some kind of weird alien wildlife. Let's do another one. 22, investigate an oddity on an imperial planet. Okay, 63, a farming world is under alien attack and its governor has requested aid in dealing with the aliens before vital crops are destroyed. So since we know, for example, that groks are herd animals herded by humans, and so are dinosaurs, perfectly possible that we might have some of those in there, and that, you know, during the battle there, fences and enclosures might get blown up and they might go on the rampage. So these are kind of twists or complications to existing scenarios. There are a few scenarios that deal directly with a monster. So for example, one of them is about the governor of an imperial world becoming a vampire. However it works. I actually played a version of this scenario in a 40K game, which was celebrating a friend's 40th birthday. So 40K for 40 years, I guess. But I mentioned this only because when he wrote up the scenario, my friend entitled it Out for the Count, which I find extremely funny. So I think there's an assumption here that the GM has a collection of miniatures and scenery that is eclectic, right? Because the GM is responsible for like the world and the creatures, not the armies or forces of the two players. And part of that understanding is that this is a game within the broader spectrum of miniatures games and RPGs. You know, one of the things that I think really changes between first and second edition 40K and maybe like third and fourth edition Warhammer Fantasy. Obviously, this is a time of great change at Games Workshop. But one of the big changes is that I think the assumption that people who play Warhammer are almost certain to play D&D kind of goes away. And GW really attempts to present its games as their own thing rather than part of a broader wargaming and role-playing hobby. So for example, just to look at the idea of the assumptions that you are already a wargamer and or role player, the scenario included in the book, The Battle at the Farm, includes a kind of like ruined old-timey farmhouse, I think because Priestley assumed that the type of people buying this book would be likely to have something like that. It doesn't have to be exactly as described in the scenario, it points out, but if you play Napoleonic wargaming, or fantasy wargaming, or World War II wargaming, then there's a good chance that you have something like that. The sequel to The Battle at the Farm, The Battle of Jadeberry Hill, has a tunnel going into a hillside, the famous zoom way of this scenario, and that is presumably because that's a common piece of model railroad scenery. My guess would be that every British kid that was into model railroads had the exact same vacuformed tunnel going into a hill piece, and that specific piece, which you could still buy in any model zone in the country, as of, you know, whenever Model Zone went out of business 10 years ago or so, or less even maybe, that, you know, every kid who had at one point liked model railroads probably had that exact thing. I think a lot of the monster selection reflects this. For starters, we have some monsters that don't require a model at all, like the carnivorous sand clam, the rippy fish, the lash worm. These are creatures that would just be like an X on the GM's map because they're too small or they're underwater or they're underground. They are just hazards that the players can activate by stepping into the wrong place. Some of the monsters are based on commonly available toys. So examples of this would include the crotalid, as we said, right? The book actually says this is like a toy alligator. The dinosaur, obviously lots of dinosaur toys around, the giant insectoids, and giant spiders, which are just, you know, regular sized insect or spider toys, but they're real big because it's 20 millimeter. And maybe the razor wing, which could just be any bird. This, of course, reminds one of the Chinasaur monsters from D&D, the Bullet, the Owlbear, the Rust Monster, etc. And in fact, of course, we can see the Pharaoh Beast echoing the Rust Monster. Now, Citadel did make AD&D miniatures, which brings us to the next category, miniatures you already own. Now, I don't know what the like production timeline is, so I don't know if you could still walk into a Games Workshop and buy those AD&D figures in 1987. I believe not, but I could be wrong. But whether or not you had those specific ones, you might have D&D monsters, you might have some old ones. Rick Priestley might have had them when he was playtesting the game. So examples of this include the Amble, which I think we can take to be an Umber Hulk, you know, a tunnel-dwelling pincer armored monster. Eventually GW would release an Amble miniature, so there's that. Horses, obviously. Maybe the Grox, if the Grox is a cold one from Citadel. Maybe some others like the Gyrinks or the Cthulian Cudbear, right, if it's just like a bear. Those are all pretty easily accessible miniatures. You can see this in other parts of the setting as well. You know, the Adeptus Arbites are just the Judge Dredd judges, even called judges. And there are certainly some early figures that are intended to be them that are clearly just modified Judge Dredd figures. They were not released at the time and were only released much later from Foundry, not from GW. Finally, some models might be conversions. So examples of this would include the Catechin Devil, where if I had like a toy centipede and a toy scorpion, I could clip off the claws and tail of the scorpion and add them to the centipede to make a Catechin Devil. So to me, this monster section is pointing towards this kind of playstyle, one that includes PvE elements and that varies from game to game, and that doesn't require that every monster that's going to turn up once is an expensive, painstakingly detailed work of art. The text is very careful to point out ways in which you can do things quickly or cheaply. There's lots of little like DIY projects. To me, the thing that enthralled me about the Rogue Trader book was actually not so much the mythology of the setting, although I enjoyed that too, but like the sci-fi domes made by pushing a tennis ball into a bucket of wet sand in order to make a half sphere shape and then filling that impression with plaster of Paris to make a dome, the details of which are then just painted on. I love all that stuff. And that same premise applied to monsters, as we can see from the suggestion that a Catechin face eater might just be a piece of plasticine. This is something that's very important to me as someone who runs role-playing games and likes to use miniatures. I don't like to spend a lot of money or necessarily a lot of time on something that is only going to come up once in my game. It doesn't feel like a good use of my time, but more importantly, it doesn't feel like it's necessary. I think that my players will look at something that I have just kind of whipped together for the purpose, and they will appreciate it because it pleases them that it exists, regardless of their views about, you know, whether I could have shaded the whiskers better. Not everything that's going to turn up once has to be a painstakingly detailed work of art. And I think, you know, what's interesting is there's some discussion, which I think is rare in bestiaries, there's some discussion about how best to use these creatures in a game. And from the words that Priestley or whoever chooses, I think you can see the different ways in which he's thinking about these creatures. So the text even refers to some of them as nuisance monsters. So monsters that exist just to inject friction or other complications into an existing conflict. Others seem more like landscape hazards, right? Like the Sand Clans are basically just landmines. Others might be more significant combat opponents like the Amble or the Gene Stealer or the Catechin Devil. And still others might themselves be the objective of a scenario, like trying to capture a particular mimic or floater, or hunting a vampire. So I do think that within even the limited bestiary of a war game, you know, 20 pages, of which a couple are given to the plants, which I didn't talk about, they're fine. They're very much what you'd expect. They're mostly sort of terrain hazard features. Not all. But, you know, even within that relatively short length, you get a good variety of monster types, and I think a good understanding of how monsters are used in this type of game. Now, I would like to say that because I read this when I was quite young, you know, I didn't get into Rogue Trader until it was already going out. Second edition came out very shortly after the first time I read Rogue Trader. So Rogue Trader materials and Rogue Trader models, which still existed and were still kind of around, especially in the secondary market when I was younger, had this kind of slightly mysterious feeling to me, which, as we've discussed many times, was very compelling to me when I was younger. So I'd like to say that this book was so hugely influential in the way that I think about and run games, but kinda, this is just sort of how I've always thought of these things, I think, or how I have evolved into thinking about them over years. I mean, I think when I was younger, I was more on the everything must be perfect for the one session, or it doesn't matter, ends of the spectrum. And my kind of current middle position, I think, is actually something I've only really come to in the last few years. But it's very nice to see something similar existing in such an important book for the history of British gaming. James from the future here with a bit that I planned to talk about but didn't record. One thing that is interesting about the Rogue Trader Bestiary is which parts of it have made it into contemporary Warhammer 40,000. Apart from the Gene Stealer, kind of not very much, the Catacan Devil and Catacan Face Eater are referred to in the backstory of the Catacan Jungle Fighters. So the Catacan Jungle Fighters are troops that you can have in your Imperial Guard army, and these monsters are mentioned in terms of describing how terrifying the planet that they come from is. And of course, you can have horses and things. One place where you do still find some more of these creatures, I mentioned the idea of people talking about Groks in Warhammer 40,000 fiction. There's also an Amboll in the Blackstone Fortress game. There's an Ambot, a kind of mining robot based on an Amboll, I think it's a Necromunda, and there's a Gyrinx that comes as like a companion to one character model in Warhammer 40,000. But in general, these monsters have not persisted into the modern game. And I think the reason for that is simply that the type of conflict that the game is modeling has changed. The role of the Game Master has gone away for reasons of practicality. The game is much more of a heads-up, two-players-fight kind of situation. There's nothing wrong with that, but it is a notable difference from how it used to be. I personally think it would be fun to see the Bouncer. Maybe the Bouncer is a little bit like a Squig Hopper. I think it would be fun to see some of these creatures come back, but I understand why people might not want to pay Games Workshop prices for models that provide no advantage to their army, and indeed, maybe harm it. So that's just about all the Rogue Trader we have time for today. Kyle, I hope that you enjoyed today's episode. Thank you very much for your continued support. In our next episode, we're going to be taking a look at some monsters from the pen of one of our listeners, so I hope that you'll join me then for Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening. If you've got a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, why not get in touch? I'm on Twitter as @GonzoHistory, on Mastodon as GonzoHistory@Dice.camp, or you can find me on Instagram at MonsterManGonzo, or drop me an email, GonzoHistory@gmail.com. Our theme music is an extract from Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, and is used under a Creative Commons Attribution license. Our cover art is by Ray Otis. Thanks for listening, and please join me next time for Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great.